changes. I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 639 of Unwelcome Guests, Grave Reflections on Technology and Freedom. I'm Robin Upton, and an unusual show for you this week in that all three speakers are now deceased. We conclude with E.F. Schumacher, before him we have author Kurt Vonnegut, and we start with one of the oldest recordings we've ever had on the show. This is from a half century ago, March 1962, a remarkably prescient Aldous Huxley is speaking on the prospects for techno-totalitarianism, and his lecture is called The Ultimate Revolution.
Now an essayist, novelist, who during the spring semester is residing at the university in his capacity as a Ford research professor. Mr. Huxley has recently returned from a conference at the Institute for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara, where the discussion focused on the development of new techniques by which to control and direct human behavior. Traditionally, it has been possible to suppress individual freedom through the application of physical coercion, through the appeal of ideologies, through the manipulation of man's physical and social environment, and more recently through the cruder techniques of psychological conditioning. The ultimate revolution about which Mr. Huxley will speak today concerns itself with the development of new behavioral controls which operate directly upon the psychophysiological organisms of man, that is, the capacity to replace external constraint by internal compulsion. As those of us who are familiar with Mr. Huxley's works well know, this is a subject with which he has been concerned for quite a period of time. Mr. Huxley will make a presentation of approximately half an hour, followed by some brief discussions and questions by the two panelists sitting to my left, Ms. Lillian Rivlin and Mr. John Post, and Mr. Huxley. First of all, I'd like to say that the conference at Santa Barbara was not directly concerned with the control of the mind. That was a conference, there have been two of them now, at the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco, one this year, which I didn't attend, and one 2 years ago, where there was a considerable discussion on this subject. At Santa Barbara, we were talking about technology in general and the effects it's likely to have on society and the problems related to technological transplanting of technology into underdeveloped countries. Well, now, in regard to this problem of the ultimate revolution, this has been very well summed up by the moderator. In the past, we can say that all revolutions have essentially aimed at changing the environment in order to change the individual. I mean, there's been the political revolution, the economic revolution. In the time of the Reformation, the religious revolution. All these aimed, as I say, not directly at the human being, but at his surroundings, so that by modifying the surroundings, you did achieve, an effect upon the human being. Today, we are faced, I think, with the approach of what may be called the ultimate revolution, the final revolution, where a man can act directly on the mind-body of his fellows. Well, needless to say, some kind of direct action on human mind-bodies has been going on since the beginning of time. But this has generally been of a violent nature. The techniques of terrorism have been known from time immemorial, and people have employed them with more or less ingenuity, sometimes with the utmost crudity, sometimes with a good deal of skill acquired by a process of trial and error, finding out what the best ways of using torture, imprisonment, constraints of various kinds. But as I think it was Metternich said many years ago, you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. This seems to me the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say. And this is a problem which has interested me for many years, and about which I wrote 30 years ago a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system. And since then, I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem, and I have noticed with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already, and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude. Well, this process, as I say, has gone on for over the years, and I become more and more interested in what is happening. And here I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently in George Orwell's book, 1984. Orwell wrote his book between 45 and 48, at the time when the Stalinist terror regime was still in full swing, and just after the collapse of the Hitlerian terror regime. And his book, which I admire greatly, it's a book of very great talent and extraordinary ingenuity, shows, is so to say a projection into the future of the immediate past, of what for him was the immediate past, and the immediate present. It was a projection into the future of a society where control was exercised wholly by terrorism and the violent attacks upon the mind body of individuals. Whereas my own book, which was written in 1932, when there was only a mild dictatorship in the form of Mussolini in existence, was not overshadowed by the idea of terrorism, And I was therefore free, in a way which Orwell was not free, to think about these other methods of control, these non-violent methods. And I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. That if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, having their differences ironed out and being made amenable to mass production methods on the social level, if you can do this, then you have you are likely to have a much more stable and much more lasting society, a much more easily controllable society than you would if you were relying wholly on clubs and firing squads and concentration camps. So that my own feeling is that the 1984 picture was tinged, of course, by the immediate past and the present in which Orwell was living, but that the past and present of those years does not represent, I feel, the likely trend of what is going to happen. Needless to say, we shall never get rid of terrorism. This will always find its way to the surface. But I think that insofar as dictators become more and more scientific, more and more concerned with a technically perfectly running society, they will be more and more interested in the kind of techniques which I imagined and described from existing realities in Brave New World. So that it seems to me then that this ultimate revolution is really not very far away, that we already a number of the techniques for bringing about this kind of control are here, and it remains to be seen when and where and by whom they will first be applied in any large scale. And first, let me talk about a little bit about the improvement even in the techniques of terrorism. I think there have been improvements. Pavlov, after all, made some extremely profound observations, both on animals and on human beings. And he found, among other things, that conditioning techniques applied to animals or humans in a state either of psychological or physical stress sank in, so to say, very deeply into the mind-body of the creature, and were extremely difficult to get rid of, that they seem to be embedded more deeply than other forms of conditioning. And this, of course, this fact, I think, was discovered empirically in the past. People did make use of many of these techniques. But the difference between the old empirical intuitive methods and our own methods is the difference between a sort of hit-and-miss craftsman's point of view and the genuinely scientific point of view. I mean, I think there is a real difference between ourselves and, say, the inquisitors of the 16th century. We know much more precisely what we are doing than they knew, and we can extend, because of our theoretical knowledge, we can extend what we are doing over a wider area with a greater assurance of producing something which really works. In this context, I would like to mention the extremely interesting chapters in Dr. William Sargent's Battle for the Mind, where he points out how intuitively some of the great religious teachers, leaders of the past, hit on the Pavlovian method. He He speaks specifically of Wesley's method of producing conversion, which were essentially based upon a technique of heightening psychological stress to the limit by talking about hellfire, and so making people extremely vulnerable to suggestion, and then suddenly releasing this stress by offering hopes of heaven. And this is a very interesting chapter of showing how completely, on purely intuitive and empirical grounds, a skilled natural psychologist, as Wesley was, could discover these Pavlovian methods. Well, as I say, we now know the reason why these techniques worked, and there is no doubt at all that we can, if we want to, carry them much further than was possible in the past. And of course, in the recent history of brainwashing, both as applied to prisoners of war and to the lower personnel within the Communist Party in China, we see that the Pavlovian methods have been applied systematically and with extraordinary efficacy. I mean, I think there can be no doubt that by the application of these methods, a very large army of totally devoted people has been created. The conditioning has been driven in, so to say, by a kind of psychological iontophoresis, into the very depths of the of people's being, and has got so deep that it's very difficult for it ever to be rooted out. And these methods, I think, are a real refinement on the older methods of terror, because they combine methods of terror with methods of acceptance, method that the person who he is subjected to a form of terroristic stress, but for the purpose of inducing a kind of voluntary, quotes, acceptance of the state and the psychological state into which he has been driven, and the state of affairs within which he finds himself. So that, as I say, there has been, I think, a definite improvement, shall we say, even in the techniques of terrorism. Well, then we come to the consideration of other techniques, of non-terroristic techniques for inducing consent and for inducing people to love their servitude. I don't think I can possibly go into all of them, because I don't know all of them, but I mean, I can mention a few of the more obvious methods which can now be used and which are based upon recent scientific findings. First of all, there are the methods connected with straight suggestion and hypnosis. I think we know much more about this subject than was known in the past. People, of course, have always known about suggestion, and although they didn't know the word hypnosis, they certainly practiced it in various ways. But we have, I think, a much greater knowledge of the subject than in the past, and we can make use of our knowledge in ways which I think the past was probably never able to make use of it. For example, one of the things we now know for certain is that there is, of course, an enormous, I mean, this has been always known, a very great difference between individuals in regard to their suggestibility. But we now, I think, know pretty clearly the sort of statistical structure of a population in regard to its suggestibility. It's very interesting when you look at the findings in different fields. I mean, in the field of hypnosis, in the field of administering placebos, for example, in the field of general suggestion in states of drowsiness or of light sleep, you will find the same sorts of orders of magnitude continually cropping up. You will find, for example, that the experienced hypnotists will tell one that the number of people, the percentage of people who can be hypnotized with the utmost facility, just like that, is about 20%. That about a corresponding number at the other end of the scale are very, very difficult or almost impossible to hypnotize, and that in between there lies a large mass of people who can, with more or less difficulty, be hypnotized, they can gradually be, if you work hard enough at it, be got into the hypnotic state. And in the same way, one the same sort of figures crop up again, for example, in relation to the administration of placebos. A big experiment was carried out 3 or 4 years ago in the General Hospital in Boston on post-operative cases where several hundred men and women suffering comparable kinds of pain after serious operations were given injections whenever they asked for them, whenever the pain got bad, and the injections 50% of the time were of morphia and 50% of the time were of distilled water. And about 20% of those who went through the experiment, about 20% of them got just as much relief from the distilled water as from the morphia. About 20% got no relief from the distilled water, and in between were those who got some relief or got relief occasionally. So here again we see the same sort of distribution. And similarly with regard to what in Brave New World I called hypnopedia, which is the sleep teaching. I was talking not long ago to a man who manufactures records which people can listen to during the light part of sleep. I mean, these are records for getting rich, for sexual satisfaction, for confidence in salesmanship, and so on. And he said it's very interesting that these records are sold on a money-back basis, and he says that there is regularly between 15 and 20% of people who write indignantly saying the records don't work at all, and he sends the money back at once. On the other hand, there are somewhat over 20% who write enthusiastically saying they're now much richer, their sexual life is much better, etc., etc. And these, of course, are the dream clients, and they buy more of these records. And then in between are those who complain they're not getting much results, and they have to have letters written to them saying, well, go persist, my dear, go on, and you will get there. And they generally do get results in the long run. Well, as I say, this on the basis of this, I think we see quite clearly that human populations can be categorized according to their suggestibility fairly clearly. I suspect very strongly that this 20% is the same in all these cases. And I suspect also that it would not be at all difficult to recognize in very early childhood who were those who were extremely suggestible, who were those who were extremely unsuggestible, and who were those who occupied the intermediate space. Quite clearly, if everybody were extremely unsuggestible, organized society would be quite impossible. And if everybody were extremely suggestible, then dictatorship would be absolutely inevitable. I mean, it's very fortunate we have people who are moderately suggestible in the majority and who therefore preserve us from dictatorship but do permit organized society to be formed. But once given the fact that there are these 20% of highly suggestible people, it becomes quite clear that this is a matter of enormous political importance. For example, any demagogue who is able to get hold of a large number of these 20% of suggestible people and to organize them is really in a position to overthrow any government in any country. And I mean, I think this, after all, we've had the most incredible example in recent years of what can be done by efficient methods of suggestion and persuasion in the form of Hitler. Anybody who's read, for example, Bullock's Life of Hitler comes forth from this with a sort of horrified admiration for this infernal genius who really understood human weaknesses, I think, almost better than anybody, and who exploited them with all the resources then available. I mean, he knew everything. I mean, for example, he knew intuitively this Pavlovian truth that conditioning installed in a state of stress or fatigue it goes much deeper than conditioning installed at other times. This was why all his big speeches were organized at night. He speaks of this quite frankly, of course, in Mein Kampf. He says this was done solely because people are tired at night and therefore are much less capable of resisting persuasion than they would be during the day. And we see in all his techniques, he was using... He had discovered intuitively and by trial and error great many of the weaknesses which we now know about on a sort of scientific way, I think much more clearly than he does, than he did. But the fact remains that this differential suggestibility, this susceptibility to hypnosis, I do think is something which has to be considered very carefully in relation to any kind of thought about democratic government. I mean, if there are 20% of the people who can really be suggested into believing almost anything, as evidently they can be, then we have to take extremely careful steps to prevent the rise of demagogues who will drive them on into extreme positions and then organize them into very, very dangerous armies, private armies, which may overthrow the government. Well, this, as I say, is in this field of pure persuasion, I think we do know much more than we did in the past, and obviously we now have mechanisms for multiplying the demagogue's voice and image in a quite hallucinatory way. I mean, the television and the radio, Hitler was making enormous use of the radio. He could speak to millions of people simultaneously. I mean, this alone, of course, creates an enormous gulf between the modern and the ancient demagogue. And the ancient demagogue could only appeal to as many people as his voice could reach by the yelling at his utmost, but the modern demagogue can touch literally millions at a time, and of course with the multiplication of his image, he can produce this kind of hallucinatory effect, which is of enormous hypnotic and suggestive importance. But then there are various other methods which one can think of, which have, thank heaven, as yet not been used, but which obviously could be used. There is, for example, the pharmacological method. This was one of the things I talked about in Brave New World. I invented a hypothetical drug called Soma, which, of course, could not exist as it stood there because it was simultaneously a stimulant, a narcotic, and a hallucinogen, which seems unlikely in one substance. But the point is that in several, if you applied several different substances, you could get almost all these results even now. And the really interesting thing about the new chemical substances, the new mind-changing drugs, is this, that whereas, if you look back into history, it's clear that man has always had a hankering after mind-changing chemicals. He has always desired to take holidays from himself. And this is the most extraordinary fact of all, is that every naturally occurring stimulant, narcotic, sedative, or hallucinogen was discovered before the dawn of history. I don't think there is one single one of these naturally occurring ones which modern science has discovered. Modern science, of course, has discovered better ways of extracting the active principles from these drugs, and, of course, has discovered numerous ways of synthesizing new substances of extreme power. But the actual discovery of these naturally occurring things was made by underneath the lake dwellings, the early Neolithic, which have been dug up in Switzerland. We find poppy heads, which looks as though people were already using this most ancient and powerful and most dangerous of narcotics, even in the days before the rise of agriculture, so that man was apparently a dope addict before he was a farmer, which is a very, very curious comment on human nature. But I mean, the difference, as I say, between the ancient mind changers, the traditional mind changers, and these new substances is that they were extremely harmful, and the new ones are not. I mean, even the permissible mind changer, alcohol, is not entirely harmless, as people may have noticed. The other ones, the non-permissible ones, such as opium and cocaine, opium and all its derivatives, are very harmful indeed. They rapidly produce addiction and in some cases lead at an extraordinary rate to physical degeneration and death. Whereas these new substances, this is really very extraordinary, that a number of these new mind-changing substances can produce enormous revolutions within the mental side of our being, and yet do almost nothing to the physiological side. I mean, you can have an enormous revolution, for example, with LSD-25 or with the newly synthesized drug psilocybin, which is the active principle of the Mexican sacred mushroom. You can have this enormous mental revolution with no more physiological revolution than you would get from drinking two cocktails. And this is really a most extraordinary fact. And it is, of course, true that pharmacologists are producing a great many wonder drugs which where the cure is almost worse than the disease. Every new edition of medical textbooks contains a longer and longer chapter on what are called iatrogenic diseases, that is to say, diseases caused by doctors. And this is quite true, that many of the wonder drugs are extremely dangerous. I mean, they can produce extraordinary effects, and in critical conditions they should certainly be used, but they should be used with the utmost caution. But there is evidently a whole class of drugs affecting the central nervous system which can produce enormous changes in sedation, in euphoria, in energizing the whole mental process, without doing any perceptible harm to the body. And in this sense, this represents, it seems to me, the most extraordinary revolution, that it's in the hands of a dictator, these substances of one kind or another could be used with complete harmlessness, and the result would be that I mean, you can imagine a euphoric which would make people thoroughly happy even in the most abominable circumstances. I mean, these things are possible. I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. I mean, after all, this has even been true with the crude oil drugs. I mean, as a houseman years ago remarked apropos of Milton's Paradise Lost, he says, and beer does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to man. And beer is, of course, an extremely crude drug compared with these ones. And you can certainly say that some of the psychic energizers and the new hallucinants can do incomparably more than Milton and all the theologians combined could possibly do to make the terrifying mystery of our existence seem more tolerable than it does. So that here, I think, one has an enormous area in which the ultimate revolution could function very well indeed, an area in which a great deal of control could be used by, not through terror, but through making life seem much more enjoyable than it normally does, enjoyable to the point where, as I've said before, human beings come to love a state of things which, by any reasonable and decent human standard, they ought not to love. And this, I think, is perfectly possible. Well, then, very briefly, let me speak about one of the more recent developments of in the sphere of neurology, the implantation of electrodes in the brain. This, of course, has been done on a large scale in animals, and in a few cases it's been done in hopeless in cases of the hopelessly insane. And it is, anybody who's watched the behavior of rats with electrodes planted in different centers must come away from this experience with the most extraordinary doubts about what on earth is in store for us if ever this is got hold of by a dictator. If I saw not long ago some rats in Magoon's laboratory at UCLA. There were two sets of them, one with electrodes planted in a pleasure center. And these rats were, the technique was that they had a bar which they pressed and which turned on a very small current for a short space of time, which we had a wire connected with their electrode, and which stimulated this pleasure center, which was evidently absolutely ecstatic, because these rats were pressing the bar 18,000 times a day. Apparently, if you kept them from pressing the bar for a day, they would press the bar 36,000 times on the following day and would fall till they fell down in complete exhaustion. And they would neither eat nor be interested in the opposite sex and would just go on pressing the bar. Then the most extraordinary rats were those where the electrode was planted halfway between a pleasure and a pain center, and where evidently the result was a kind of mixture of wonderful ecstasy in being on the rack at the same time. And you would see the rat sort of looking at its bar and sort of saying, to be or not to be, that is the question. And finally would approach and do it, and then it would go back and, with this awful, if one can humanize or anthropomorphize, he was feeling something terribly mixed. And he would wait for quite a long time before pressing the bar again, but he would always press it again. this was the extraordinary thing. And I notice in this most recent issue of Scientific American, there's a very interesting article on electrodes in the brains of chickens, where the technique is very ingenious. You sink into their brain a little socket with a screw on it, and the electrode then can be screwed deeper and deeper into the brain stem, and you can test at any moment, according to the depth of it goes in fractions of a millimeter, of what you're stimulating. And these creatures are not merely stimulated by wire. They are fitted with a miniaturized radio receiver weighing less than an ounce, which is attached to them, so that they can be communicated with at a distance. They can run about in the barnyard, and you can press the button, and this particular area of the brain to which the electrode has been screwed down to will be stimulated, and you will get these fantastic phenomena that a sleepy chicken will suddenly get up and rush about, or an active chicken will suddenly sit down and go to sleep, or a hen will suddenly start sitting as though it were hatching out an egg, or a rooster will start fighting, or will suddenly go into a state of extreme depression. The whole picture of the absolute control of the drives is terrifying. And in the cases, a few cases in which this has been done with very sick human beings, the effects are evidently very remarkable too. I was talking last summer to in England to Gray Walter, who is the most eminent exponent of the electroencephalogram techniques in England, and he was telling me that he's seen hopeless inmates of asylums with these things in their heads, and that these people were suffering from uncontrollable depression, and they'd had the electrodes inserted into something resembling, evidently, the pleasure center of the rat. Anyhow, when they felt too bad, they just pressed a button and the battery in their pocket. And he said the result was fantastic. The mouth would go down, would suddenly turn up, and they would evidently feel, for I don't know for how long at a time, very cheerful and happy. So that here again one sees the most extraordinary revolutionary techniques which are now available to us. Now, what is obviously perfectly clear is that for the present these techniques are not being much used except in a purely experimental way. But I think it is extraordinarily important for us to realize, further to realize what is happening, to make ourselves acquainted with what has already happened, and then to use a certain amount of imagination to extrapolate into the future the sort of things that might happen. I mean, what might happen if these fantastically powerful techniques were used by unscrupulous people in authority? What on earth would happen? What sort of society would we get? And I think this is peculiarly important because, as one sees in looking back over history, we have allowed in the past all those advances in technology which have profoundly changed the social and individual life, we've allowed them to take us by surprise. I mean, it seems to me that during the late 18th century and early 19th century, when the new machines were making possible the factory system, it was not beyond the wit of man to see to look at what was happening and to project into the future, and maybe to forestall the really dreadful consequences which plagued England and most of Western Europe and most of this country for about 50 or 60 years, the horrible abuses of the factory system. I mean, if a certain amount of forethought had been devoted to the problem at that time, if people had first of all found out what was happening and then used their imagination to see what might happen, and then had gone on to work out means by which the worst applications of the new techniques should not take place, and then I think Western humanity might have been spared about three generations of utter misery which was imposed upon the poor at that time. And similarly with various technological advances now. I mean, it's quite clear we have to start thinking very, very hard about the problems of automation. And again, I think we have to think still more profoundly about the problems which may arise in relation to these new techniques, which may contribute to this ultimate revolution. Our business is to, first of all, as I say, to be aware of what is happening, then to use our imaginations to see what might happen, how this might be abused, and then, if possible, to see that the enormous powers which we now possess, thanks to these scientific and technological advances, shall be used for the benefit of human beings and not for their ultimate degradation. Thank you.
For some observations of life in the USA 40 years later, this is a 2003 interview, slightly trimmed by me, of author Kurt Vonnegut by radio presenter David Barsamian of Alternative Radio. And as usual, if you'd like to hear the full interview, you can download that from unwelcomeguests.net/639.
Kurt Vonnegut was an infantryman in World War II and was captured during the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944. He was then taken to a POW camp in Dresden in time to experience the horrific Allied firebombing of the defenseless city from the relative safety of an underground meat locker. The destruction wrought was greater than that of Nagasaki. He is now a self-described fourth-generation German-American living in easy circumstances. He has written over 20 books and ranks among America's most widely read and best-loved authors. Kurt Vonnegut was interviewed at his home in Midtown Manhattan by David Barsamian.
If a journalist from Tralfamador came to Earth today, what would they report back to their home planet?
Well, that we are a people with no past, because we have a president who knows absolutely no history, and he's surrounded by men who pay no attention to history, and they imagine that they are great politicians inventing something new, which is tyranny. And in fact, it's really quite old stuff, but they imagine they're being creative.
You're here in Baghdad on the subway, as it were, just a few blocks from the UN, and on February 15th there was a mass demonstration in New York, and you took part in it?
Well, I was simply there. I didn't speak.
What do you think about the efficacy, in practical terms, of people turning out at protests and marching?
I've said something about that before, and of course, I'm an old guy, so I was protesting during the Vietnam War, which was atrocious. Well, we killed, I think, 50 Asiatics for every loyal American. But anyway, as I've said before, I'll say again that every artist worth a damn in this country was terribly opposed to that war, finally, when it was evident what a fiasco and meaningless butchery it was. And we formed sort of a laser beam of protest. Every painter, every writer, every stand-up comedian, every composer, every novelist, every poet aimed in the same direction. So it was like a narrow beam. It's just all aimed in one direction. And I said the power of this incredible new weapon turned to be that of a banana cream pie is 3 feet in diameter, dropped from a stepladder 4 feet high. Yes, is the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition their government for a redress of grievances is now ain't worth a pitcher of warm spit. And that is because TV will not come and treat it respectfully.
Well, hundreds of thousands turned up in New York, perhaps a half a million, and the figures from around the world, as high as 10, 11 million people turned out on February 15th. The commander-in-chief dismissed these protesters as a focus group.
Yes.
What might he be thinking, comparing millions of people to a focus group?
He was told what to say. And, you know, the word thinking does not apply in this case. He's very much like Ronald Reagan, in fact, an actor who will deliver whatever lines he's given. And Reagan and I worked for the General Electric Company at the same time. And he was on his way down, and I was on the way up. But he was sent out as a darling American, and indeed he is. A very appealing man. To speak to power and light companies and to chambers of commerce on the evils of socialism. And, of course, General Electric saw socialism as evil, because working people might get funny ideas about what they were entitled to.
Well, during World War I, Senator Hiram Johnson said that the first casualty of war is truth. In this current atmosphere of war that's pervading the United States today, do you still think that holds true?
Yes, of course, and half the truth dies, because of course there are two sides to every argument. But half of the truth is now suppressed by TV, which simply does not report it or does not respect it. Yes, they will have a few freaks on, but the New York Post, a very liberal paper, as you know, was talking about, you know, the movie stars and people who don't know anything coming to the aid of the bad guys. television is really something. I mean, it taught my children before they went to school and continues to teach them even now.
You've written about the impact of the cathode tube, as you call it, on American culture and life. And I was interested that you talked about going to the theater and seeing Our Town and Streetcar Named Desire and Death of a Salesman and what kind of influence it had on you simply because you were in an audience with other human beings.
That's right. It is the model for a theater is, of course, a religious event, a religious community event. Yes, and so at the end when Willie Loman's wife says attention must be paid, is the whole audience, yes, they wanted to say amen, amen. And so, yes, it can be a religious experience.
Today, with the way war is being produced as a made-for-TV event, you know, Showdown in Iraq with graphics and maps as such, war is kind of turned into a video game for the armies of couch potatoes out there.
It's incumbent on the president to entertain. And I must say that Clinton did a better job of entertaining. And was forgiven for that, incidentally, for the scandals. Bush feels a need to entertain, and I'm sure any president is competing for time on TV. And so what he is going to entertain us with is what I call Republican Super Bowl, which is played by the lower classes using live ammunition.
I must confess, Mr. Vonnegut, I'm feeling a little bit nervous because I'm looking around and I don't see your survival kit in evidence. I don't see the duct tape on the windows and the plastic sheeting. Are you ready?
I want to die.
Well, I mean, it seems that right now, with the kind of, I can only describe it as madness that's going on, that this would just be a gold mine for satirists and stand-up comics and comedians. I mean, but is that happening? Do you see people going to town on this issue?
No, it's because the government satirizes itself, and so the job is no longer there to be done. All we can wish, really, is, you know, the satirists have tried to make this a better country or whatever country they're in. And we just hope that there be a large number of Americans who will realize how dumb this all is and how greedy and how vicious. Such an audience is dwindling all the time, again, I think, because of TV. But I have said one good thing about TV is if you die violently, God forbid, on camera, you will not have died in vain because you would have been great entertainment.
Recently, I was hand-wanded at an airport. I wonder if you've had that privilege yet.
I get strip-searched every time. I have to take off my shoes and everything else.
I was interested in talking to the guy who was hand-wanding me. I said, is this a regular or irregular verb?
And may I say, you look a little funny. If you came through my line, I'd figure you as a possible wrong off. But I would change your appearance if I were you.
Dye my hair, perhaps?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, being an Armenian isn't that far from being an Arab, is it?
They both begin with A. I must confess to you, you know, I'm not one of those Vonnegut devotees. I'm sorry to tell you. I haven't read all your books.
Well, then go away.
Okay, I'll be leaving soon. But one I did read recently was Slaughterhouse 5, and I was interested to see that you wrote, not many Americans knew how much worse the bombing of Dresden in February 1945 was, the bombing which you were under, literally, had been than Hiroshima. I'm wondering now, some five decades later, is that still the case? Is Dresden still pretty much unknown?
What they've done... you know, the truth continues to die after the war. There's still plenty of truths to be killed, and the best number I can get for casualties, and of course what they did was turn a whole old city, completely combustible, into a single column of flame. And You know, that's as good as an atom bomb, really. And the number I've heard is, and I'm not a vested interest, you know, it's 135,000. The place was full of refugees, because the city had been untouched. It was full of refugees, and it was also full of hospitals for the wounded. It was unprotected, had no air raid shelters, and did not expect to be attacked, and declared itself an open city, which I think is probably a medieval concept promulgated by some pope. But anyway, 135,000, and now the number I hear again is 35,000.
It's interesting that the head of the RAF at the time, which really pulverized the city at
Bomber
night,
Harris,
was in fact also bombing Iraq in the early 1920s when the British were consolidating power over that country.
Oh, where's Iraq anyway?
Iraq is between a hard place.
Anyway, yes, I didn't. Well, that's an interesting detail. It's actually, the British Parliament debated the bombing of cities and saying, you know, why is it that every time we capture a city, you know, there are no roofs on the buildings anymore, the plumbing doesn't work, and so we might as well camp out. I can't imagine either of our legislatures debating bombing, for instance. You know, the Brits are sportsmen in a way, as they think in terms of games, and they thought it was unsporting, a lot of the RAF guys, and were ashamed to have simply turned loose explosives. I mean, they weren't aiming. They were just dropping stuff on the city. The aiming point in Dresden was a soccer stadium. As soon as you saw the soccer stadium, you'd open your bomb bays and let fly. But anyway, when there it was proposed, I don't know, maybe about 8 years ago now, that a monument be put up to Bomber Harris on Trafalgar Square, I think it was, and a lot of the RAF guys said, no, there is some monument, but it's a very modest one. And he, again, about the British idea of sportsmanship, he was the only marshal who was not given a VC when the war was over.
You asked where Iraq was playfully, but Thomas Friedman on the Charlie Rose show on PBS said that, and I'm quoting here, Iraq is a country that very few Americans know anything about. And I was curious to see if Rose would, you know, ask, well, why is that? But he didn't. He just let the statement pass. So this kind of ignorance among Americans, is it constructed?
I think it's geographical. I mean, we've got a hell of a lot of our own stuff to think about. We are virtually a continent in our own right with a very wide variety of ethnic groups.
But don't you think Canada is in a similar situation? And Canadians seem to be much better informed about world affairs.
Well, they have a National Health Service.
That enables them to think better?
I hope.
Tariq Ali, who's a Pakistani-born and now based in London, writer and journalist, he says, again, with tongue-in-cheek, that Americans learn their geography when they bomb a country. And when CNN says, this is Afghanistan, and here's a map, and here's the Sudan, and here's a map, and that's how Americans learn what's going on.
It's worse than that. They forget afterwards. the lesson doesn't stick. I don't know why we are so ignorant. I know that I've heard it said of the ancient Athenians during the Golden Age that they were uninterested in the cultures of those around them, languages and so forth. And so there may be this terrible state of conceitedness that makes us uninterested in others.
Milan Kundera, the Czech writer, in his book, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, wrote, "The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." Talk about how memory is used. Obviously, Americans remember some things. They remember Pearl Harbor.